Okay, the next argued case is number 22-1001, Mosaic Brands Incorporated against Ridgewallet LLC. Mr. Lawton, you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor, and Your Honors. If I may, take my mask off. Stephen Lawton here.
Yes.
Yes, good morning. So this case has many issues, and I want to address all of them, but particularly since I received an email from the court a day or so ago, I want to address those issues first. So, but before I do that, I want
to
share...
That relates to the cross-appeal, does it not? The finality? But proceed in whatever order you're prepared to proceed in.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Before I get into the law and the issues, very quickly, I want to show the court what the products at issue in this case are. This is what's called a smart wallet, and it has a elastic lips on the outer edges to keep the cards that one places inside, credit cards, for example. And then there's a clip on the back of it where money can be slid into, and it's just a more sleek form of a wallet for things that most men in particular, I suppose, keep in a wallet, which would be cash and credit cards. So it's very sleek.
Okay, can we get on the issue of inequitable conduct,
so,
which is yours?
Yes.
Yeah. What's the status of the inequitable conduct claim? I assume it's not disposed of, correct?
Correct. And to address Judge Newman as well as Judge Prost's question, the inequitable conduct issue is one that we appealed. Summary judgment motion was filed. The court denied it based on it did not find intent as a matter of summary judgment. The invalidity was confirmed of the opponent's Ridge's patent on summary judgment. So therefore, the court did not reach the inequitable conduct issue before entering final judgment because the patent was deemed invalid. So there was no practical reason to address inequitable conduct.
This is so confusing to me. Is the inequitable conduct issue still alive
in
the district court?
It is.
And it is alive how? He granted summary judgment of no inequitable conduct, right?
No.
He denied your motion for summary judgment of inequitable conduct. How is that appealable? Just as a run-of-the-mind case that we have, the issue is still alive. How on earth is that appealable?
Correct, Your Honor. You're absolutely right, and I'm not going...
You appealed it. So are you confessing error? Are you withdrawing that? Are you... Yeah. What's going on?
Well, we filed the notice of appeal before such time as the court addressed the fees issues after final judgment. The court deferred to this court to address the invalidity issue before it addressed the inequitable conduct issue as it relates to 285 fee shifting. So the court said that issue is going to be stayed. We'll wait to hear from the Federal Circuit.
So there's been no disposition of the inequitable conduct. They denied summary judgment, but it's still a live issue. Is it going to have a bench trial on it?
Well, that's yet to be seen, but we appealed the issue because we believe we were entitled to summary judgment of inequitable conduct.
And you think that's appropriate basis for an appealing when they deny summary judgment of inequitable conduct and there remains, because there's a factual dispute remaining, you get to appeal that?
Well, we believe that because that issue is so simple and because our opponent, Ridge, has not argued that it's not appealable, they've waived that issue, and so we believe that it can be addressed here today, but I'm not going to stand here before you, Your Honor, and argue to you that it's a regular course of business. I know that denials of summary judgment typically are not subjects of appeals because the district court hasn't spoken finally on the issue. And here the district court has not spoken finally on the issue. So I'm not going to say that there's precedent ad nauseum supporting this court addressing inequitable conduct as it's currently framed.
Well,
however,
I'm not looking for precedent ad nauseum. I'm looking for any precedent, and I don't think there is any.
Well, we approached this court today because Ridge has not raised that issue.
Okay.
We're here on appeal. I got the email. I did my research, and I haven't found any precedent.
Okay. So if you're in agreement that it's not properly before us, what, if any, impact, in your view, does that have on the question of whether or not we've got a final judgment at all with respect to any and all of these issues?
Right. And that was the second question posed by the court. And so there the issue is, in my mind, and again, I didn't find any cases on point, but the issue is there a preclusion of any final judgment whatsoever on any of the issues, because we've got many, or is it just preclusive as to the inequitable conduct issue?
That's my question.
And I submit, as to the latter question we've discussed, as to the former question, I don't have an opinion on that, honestly. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I have authority for that total preclusion.
Let me ask you this. Sorry to interrupt. But inequitable conduct, was it just an affirmative defense that you raised, or was it a counterclaim?
It was an affirmative defense.
All right. And I think the district court initially denied it as moot once you prevailed on anticipation, correct?
Correct.
And then you asked for reconsideration because you said we're going to file a 285 motion, and we think if there's an equitable conduct, then this may be probative of whether we prevail on our fees motion.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly.
And that's what led to whatever the district court said about an equitable conduct, right?
Exactly. That's
so
right.
I thought that, excuse me, Judge Stark.
I'm sorry. You go ahead, please, Judge Newman.
Well, what struck me is the district court appeared to recognize that it was irrelevant whether there was an equitable conduct unless there was an attorney fee issue, which would then flow after this court determined the merits of the rest of the case. And I believe the district court made a statement to that effect, and that was the reason that it wasn't going into the extreme detail. After all, it was quite contested as to whether there was an equitable conduct. Is that a fair statement of how it worked out?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the district court was being deferential to this court because it had finally decided, as a matter of summary judgment, anticipation. And so there was no reason, the patent's already invalid, so there's no reason to make it unenforceable too. And then the court recognized that, you know, assuming that anticipation summary judgment is affirmed on appeal, then we would come back and address the fees issues. But I think the court was being especially deferential. Typically, the fees issue would be finally decided, and in that would be a determination up or down on inequitable conduct. And then that issue would then be a subsequent appeal, which probably would end up being consolidated here, and we'd be here talking about all issues as a matter of final judgment. But we're not in that position. We're not in that procedural posture. But I note that the appellee has not raised that issue, and our view is that they waived that issue, although maybe it's not a matter.
What's the matter for the court
to be
decide
waived.
What's
Correct.
Appropriately before
as,
us?
As a matter of jurisdiction.
Judge Stark.
Just wanted to make clear, the only reason that you are seeking a finding of inequitable conduct, though, is to inform your 285 motion, which currently stands denied without prejudice. Is that right?
Correct. However, if for some reason the summary judgment of anticipation is reversed or vacated and we're back before the district court on the issue of invalidity / unenforceability, which in my mind are two separate issues, then obviously it remains as an affirmative defense on the merits.
Right, but is there any reason why those two shouldn't go forward together if you were not to prevail on the anticipation issue in this court? Why would we step in and decide inequitable conduct when the district court denied summary judgment on it?
Well, I think, per my discussion with Judge Prost, that we don't take a strong position on that issue because, frankly, we can live with it either way. It's a little messy, and going back and forth to the district court in Los Angeles to hear, I enjoy coming to D.C.
Can I ask you just, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I really do have an issue that seems unsettled. The district court dealt with it initially. His instinct was to say this is moot because they prevailed on invalidity. And it is certainly true that in our case law, where you have counterclaims of invalidity and inequitable conduct, then the inequitable conduct lives because it's your avenue towards potentially getting attorney's fees.
That's right.
In this case, I haven't found the smoking gun case, but it seems to me that result may be a bit different when we're talking about, as Judge Stark pointed out, affirmative defenses. Because if you've raised invalidity, anticipation, and inequitable conduct as affirmative defenses, and the judge says, we're going to find anticipation. It's not clear to me that as an affirmative defense, that issue just doesn't die and fall away, as opposed to if it were a counterclaim. Do you have anything to enlighten us on your view of that question?
Well, as I stated a little bit ago, and frankly, given what your comment is and Judge Stark's question, I'm not 100% sure we didn't plead it as a counterclaim, but I could be stand correct. Obviously, it's in the record, whether it was an affirmative defense simply or a counterclaim as well.
Well,
but
I didn't see it as a counterclaim.
But the issue seems to be one of the merits of the case versus the post-judgment fee-shifting motion. So as to the merits of the case, certainly an invalid patent need not be deemed procured through inequitable conduct. It's already invalid. But then as a matter of fee-shifting, perhaps that inequitable conduct then becomes relevant again because it was in the case as an affirmative defense. It can be argued on the fee-shifting motion.
That's the question I have. Let me just move you on a little bit, and I don't want to cross over to the cross-appeal right now. But on the matter of anticipation, the other reason that inequitable conduct, our case law says, you get to hold on to it as a counterclaim is not just for attorney's fees. I think it's because inequitable conduct gets rid of the entire patent,
yes,
and not just the claims that are in dispute. One of the many odd things about this case is that the district court opinion and you all talk about the anticipation,
yes,
and the invalidity of the patent.
Yes.
Not about any particular claims.
Yes.
What is going on here?
And that brings me to the anticipation issue, which is subject to the cross appeal. But we got summary judgment of anticipation. At the district court level, as well as here, Ridge waived any issue about whether the prior art meets the claims of the patent. That issue of correspondence, if you will, was waived. They didn't argue that.
We've got this odd appeal here because we've got two different patents going on at the same time, which are typically severed in different cases. But on the 808, which is the anticipatory thing, what claims were asserted? Weren't there particular claims that were asserted?
Yes, and it was.
And so if you have claims 1 through 5 that are asserted, and the defense is anticipation, it goes to the claims, not to the patent in its entirety, right?
And quoting the district court agreed that Ridge waived its arguments by, quote, not disputing.
Waived its arguments about what? That they were defending the entire patent? That the patent in its entirety goes down?
Correct.
Beyond the claims?
They waived the argument about whether the prior art product meets each limitation of the patent. Each limitation in all claims, all asserted claims. So the correspondence issue about which element of which claim is satisfied by which part of the prior art, that was off the table because they waived that.
Is there a waiver? You assert an infringement, certain claims, and somebody asserts anticipation.
Sure.
What's on the table are the claims that are being asserted. So here they did something different, right?
Because they need not address an issue that was waived.
Okay.
Okay, and
let me ask you about claim construction.
Okay.
I think we'll get to anticipation on the cross appeal, but you're the one that's appealing claim construction in your patent, correct?
Yes.
So on this point as to whether LIF is limited to plastic,
correct,
material, it seems like pretty strong statements in the abstract and then in column 1, something to the effect of the device of the present invention is constructed of extrudable plastic materials.
Right.
Consistent with our case law, isn't that pretty clear that it's limited to plastic?
So we cited Continental Circuits v. Intel. To avoid improperly importing limitations into the claims, the cardinal sin, it's important to keep in mind the purposes of the specification are to teach and enable those of skill in the art. Not the best mode.
Well,
so,
what's the purpose of saying in two different places the product is plastic?
Well, because we're talking about the specification, need make clear what the best mode is, and that language, in our view, specifies the best mode, whereas the LIPS limitation is stated in the claims in a manner which obviously, they could be formed of all sorts of materials, and the material issue, what it's made of, was not a focus of the patent. The construction and the ability for something to form a chamber that is compressing what's inside it so it can hold it securely was the issue, not the material that it's made of.
Well, you may say that's the issue, but don't we have cases that are clear on that? Luminera, more recently Campbell Soup, that say that statements just like the ones you have in your specification, talking about the present invention, not the preferred embodiment, clearly our caseload is clear, you can't limit it to the preferred embodiment, but statements such as the ones you have there describing it as plastic are sufficient to say that this is sort of lexicography or, you know, a definitional thing. Right? I mean...
Well, our position would be that the language in the specification, including that cited by Judge Stark, is language about the invention, not of the unequivocality required by the case law for a disclaimer. Now, obviously, any patent can talk only about one embodiment, right? And the claims then define the invention, and whether or not other than one embodiment is talked about.
Well, they can talk about one embodiment, but not when you say in the spec. You're the author of the spec. Well, when you say the invention is plastic,
right?
That's not an embodiment. That we know, we read these every day. We know
Understood.
What it means to say this is the preferred embodiment, or this is an embodiment, and this is what is in the embodiment. This language is not that language, right?
Well, we believe that it is because it talks about the invention, and the invention is described in the specification in its best mode. So the invention, it doesn't say the invention is limited to or the invention
I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you cite us any case in which the language in the spec says the present invention is yada-da, and we have construed that to be, well, it's just the best mode, so we're not taking it as a definitional or as a across-the-board meaning of the limits of the invention?
I think the cases that were cited in our brief, including the Continental Circuits case, makes that distinction, and I think that's important here, especially when, you know, the patent talks about only one embodiment, the best mode, and the claims, you know, the important distinction between the specification and the claims, every patent lawyer knows, describe that preferred embodiment, you get to the claims, you get to choose your language, and that language shouldn't be limited unless it's clear. And we submit that the language cited in the specification is not a clear disavow. And that would be our position on claim construction.
Can I just ask, if you were to prevail on this plastic point, and we modified the construction not to be limited to plastic, is that enough for you to have an infringement claim? It was the limitation to plastic that led you to concede you couldn't prove infringement?
Yes. Now, we argue varying thickness as well.
Right, but you're saying you don't need that in order to show infringement.
I don't believe so, but we think it was error as well. That's why we included it in our appeal, because Ridge has agreed that the plain and ordinary meaning applies to that claim, and the district court elaborated further unnecessarily about what that plain and ordinary meaning should be, and we think that that should not be part of the official claim construction. And perhaps I'm over, so if I could reserve...
No, let's proceed to the other points as well, because we've spent a fair amount of time on equitable conduct.
With my colleague?
Any other points that you want to raise at this stage of your argument, or do you want to leave them for your cross-appeal?
I think out of deference to my colleague, I'll leave them for... If the court will indulge me with a couple minutes on rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Good. Thank you. So we'll hear from the other side. We'll hear from Mr. Wood.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Weed, and I represent Ridge Wallet in these appeals. Your Honors, the court below erred by granting summary judgment of anticipation of the 808 patent.
Well, that's your cross appeal. So can we just get involved in responding to what your friend said? Can we start with inequitable conduct? He seems to concede that the appeal of the denial of a motion for summary judgment is arguably not properly before us. Do you have any comments on that point?
I think I would agree with one caveat, which is that the final judgment here is a little bit strange because it does indicate perhaps partial summary judgment of materiality. So if we look at the final judgment,
I'm aware of that. Yeah, but can you have partial? So does that matter? I mean, you can't split up inequitable conduct to intent on one hand and materiality on the other and appeal them separately. I've never seen that happen
before. I agree, and I think the final judgment at its heart makes a finding on the issue of liability for infringement, not on the issue of whether there was inequitable conduct or invalidity or non-infringement, for example. The judge below resolved the issue of whether or not there was liability, and he did so by finding anticipation. And so the inequitable conduct ruling is essentially surplus to the ultimate judgment that there is no liability. And that's the thing we are appealing, is the judgment of no liability here. Okay. And I think you are correct, Judge Stark, that there is no counterclaim for inequitable conduct. They are all just affirmative defenses.
So do you think there's anything to the argument? I mean, I know our cases say, as a counterclaim, inequitable conduct lives on. But when it's an affirmative defense, I actually don't know the answer to this. But if it's an affirmative defense, and let's assume you prevail on the anticipation, the patent goes down in anticipation, do you think that changes the result otherwise, which is that the right for attorney's fees and all this stuff remains?
Well, certainly it will affect the attorney fee motion, because if this court reverses the anticipation finding, I think that's a basis for the fee motion. And we would have to go back and litigate the issue of invalidity then at some kind of a fact-finding, whether it's a trial or more motion practice. And then ultimately the other affirmative defenses of non-infringement and inequitable conduct, which ultimately may be a part of a fee motion. But if we reverse here on anticipation, we have to go back and litigate the issue of whether there's liability.
Okay, let me. So before we get into the anticipation thing, just you want to respond to your friend's discussion with Judge Stark about infringement, and namely the claim construction. And so what is your response to his argument that this language on the present invention is just a description of the best mode and therefore is not any kind of a disavowal, lexicography, or whatever you want to call it?
I think we, like the lower court, agree with it. It seems like the questions that were asked before, that the language is unequivocal in the specification. It says, it talks about the device of the present invention. And at other parts of the specification, the drafters chose to describe embodiments of the invention. They didn't always limit the disclosure to the device of the present invention. But in column 1, which is appendix page 9, there is unequivocal the device of the present invention language, and we think the judge got it absolutely correct below.
Let me ask you about further down, though, in column 1, under the brief summary of the invention, there's a list of the desirable features of the invention. And it says, for example, that it's desirable to provide a money clip and card holder that is inexpensive to construct and that is lightweight, durable, and comfortable. But then it comes to what it's made of, and it says it's desirable to provide a holder that may be constructed of an injectable plastic material that has desired rigidity and flexibility to perform its desired duties. Wouldn't a person of skill in the art notice the difference between is and may be and determine that the plastic is not necessarily a requirement?
Well, I think that's where we have to look very carefully at the language in the specification, because what you just read is different from the language in column 1 at line 22, where the spec says the device of the present invention is constructed of extrudable plastic materials that can be joined, and it goes on. So in that passage, the patentee is saying this is what it's constructed of. There are some benefits that are discussed of other aspects of plastic materials, but I think the governing the present invention language in the top of column 1 is what applies here, because they are telling the public that when you're looking at our invention is a card holder constructed of...
So then how do you square it, though, with what it says around line 47, that it may be constructed of an injectable plastic material?
Well, again, that's where I think the language is slightly different in column 1 from what you're reading lower down in column 1, because in the top of column 1 it talks about extrudable plastic material. It says extrudable plastic materials that can be joined to produce a smooth exterior surface. And then further down, it's talking about it may be desirable to have injectable plastic materials. So it is different discussion.
So it has to be extrudable plastic, but it doesn't have to be injectable plastic.
Correct. And I don't think the may language alters the fact that in the background of the invention, the patentee tells us exactly what the invention is, at least in part.
Now, I don't expect you to...
I heard you say you don't think the claim language altered it. Doesn't the claim language control when they put this limitation in the claim in order to avoid the prior art? Doesn't that resolve any generality in the specification?
I'm sorry, Judge, I may have misspoken. What I meant to say was the word may, M-A-Y, in column 1 does not control or alter the fact that earlier in column 1 we've already been told what the invention is. So the permissive language later on doesn't affect the mandatory the invention is language higher up in column 1.
Well, it may or may not, depends on what is ultimately limited in the claim and whatever discussion in the prosecution history was relevant to the plastic composition, seems to me, was a significant factor. I also gather that that helps your position, doesn't hurt it, but to be sure that we have it straight.
Correct, yeah. I think the claim language talks about a lip. The noun in the claim is a lip. And the construction was that the lip has to be made of this language from column 1, line 22 and 23, which is the invention language. The claim construction doesn't delve into the permissive may language, M-A-Y, further down column 1.
Do you have any view to judge on response to Judge Stark's question to your friend about we've got two claim construction issues here, and his view, I know we haven't, it remains to be adjudicated, right, if in fact we were to do that. But is there anything on the record that suggests that he has to win on both in order to secure infringement?
There really isn't. I mean, there was a fair bit of complaint amendment practice below where the judge kept finding that the complaint for patent infringement didn't state a claim. I think we were on the third amended complaint by the time we got a complaint that allowed us to go forward. So there is some question, I believe, in the judge's mind below as to whether or not infringement can be proved. But ultimately, he found that there were plausible allegations. Our contention, of course, is that we have non-infringement arguments based on both constructions, but there hasn't been a fact-finding on that issue yet.
If you're ready to move to anticipation, your cross-appeal, can I start off with the question I asked your friend,
sure,
which is about what is going on here, because typically anticipation deals with claims that are asserted and not with the patent in its entirety, even covering claims that aren't asserted in this infringement.
Right, and I went back and looked in response to your question, and at Appendix 289 and 90, which is the motion for summary judgment of invalidity, we see in that portion of the record...
You said Appendix 289?
Correct, 289 and 290. And again, this is an excerpt from the motion for summary judgment that was ultimately granted, and then reconsideration was heard. But as you can see here, in the bottom of 289 at line 21... and carrying over into the top of 290, there are specific claims that are challenged here, and not all the claims were challenged. And I wasn't trial counsel, but my understanding is that not all of the claims were being asserted from the 808 patent. So I think what happened here is summary judgment was filed as to the asserted claims. The judge granted the summary judgment motion without a lot of analysis of the claim language itself. And I think he got a little bit broad with his orders because the challenge was to the asserted claims of the 808 patent. So I think the order and the final judgment might just be a little bit overbroad, but the motion practice was directed to particular claims.
Okay. Now, in the district court, your side did not dispute, I think, that Mosaic's product embodied each element of your patent. Isn't that correct? And aren't you stuck with that on appeal?
So it's true that we didn't get in and on a claim-by-claim basis say this element is not met. That is true that below that was not the approach. The approach below was to focus on we have a prior art product that's being asserted against the claims, and there's a smattering of evidence, and it doesn't raise to the level of clear and convincing evidence that a particular product was on sale in the prior art time frame that met the claim elements.
So let's talk about that. We've got the invoices. We've got somebody authenticating that these are invoices and there's a product sold. Why isn't that sufficient for at least shifting to you something other than attorney argument, raising a question as to the authenticity of those invoices? I mean, these invoices are distributed, they're used as a basis for damages calculations and cases and so forth. Why, your view, as I understand it, is this wasn't enough for summary judgment. Why not?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is where we get back to cases like the Core Wireless case, which talk about sort of the extremity of granting summary judgment of invalidity, and especially invalidity for anticipation. And so our arguments below were, we have these invoices, they were authenticated by the witness for the patent challenging entity.
Yeah.
And all the invoices say is, you know, sale of several SMC2 wallets to a golf course in Florida. And as we pointed out throughout the briefing below and here in our red brief at, I think, 23 to 28, there's a lot of discrepancy about the pictures. So sometimes we have photographs of black products that don't have a money clip. Sometimes they are silver products that do have a money clip. The backgrounds of the photos are different colors from the claim charts to the declaration. So
I don't know. So is your point that you don't know from the invoices what the product was?
Exactly, exactly.
But I thought where were the invoices in the, I'm sorry, could you give me the appendix site?
I'm sure I cited it in the brief.
Yeah, I had it. I just didn't mark it. So, oh, here they are. Is it 322?
It sounds right.
322. Okay, and they refer to the smart money clip. And in the district court's decision, he says that you don't dispute that SMCII meets each limitation. So I took from that you weren't disputing that these invoices dealt with the product that we're talking about. You're just, I guess, disputing whether or not they're real invoices?
No, I don't think that's right. We did dispute whether the invoices dealt with the product that was at issue. We didn't dispute below that there are pictures of a product whose features meet the limitations. We didn't dispute that below. And obviously we have briefing about cases like the Zenith case that we believe show that that's not of importance here because they still have to carry a burden. But our primary dispute below was, look, we have a lot of different things that are called the SMC2. We have these hand drawings that are over several different days of different embodiments of something they call the SMC2. We just don't know what it is that was being sold allegedly to these golf courses when the invoices talk about Smart Money Clip 2. We don't know if it's a thing that meets the claims or not. The point is they didn't establish by clear and convincing evidence that the very thing that was sold is the thing that they charted against the claims.
What evidence did your side put in the record to dispute any of that? Is it enough to defeat summary judgment just to say we don't believe the other side's evidence?
Candidly, I think so, Your Honor. I think, again, the Zenith case that I mentioned a moment ago says essentially where there's a failing on the part of a movement on an issue where they bear the burden, we don't have to come forward with counter evidence.
What if we think that a reasonable juror could find that Mosaic's evidence is clear and convincing, just that they don't have to find that? Where would that leave us?
I don't think that results in entitlement to judgment as a matter of law at this point. I think on summary judgment, it would still be inappropriate to grant summary judgment on that basis. It may very well be that the jury finds that way. It may very well be that after trial, some kind of judgment as a matter of law post-trial would be appropriate, but I don't think summary judgment would be appropriate in that.
You didn't move for summary judgment of no anticipation, did you?
We did not.
And did you bring forward any witnesses? Did you depose Mr. Kaminsky or anybody else on the other side?
We deposed Mr. Kaminsky and his testimony and also Mia Kaminsky's testimony, who is the CEO, are sprinkled throughout the record. I wasn't trial counsel, but I believe discovery was only open for limited purposes.
Okay, so you deposed him. Anything that you glean, I didn't see any citations in your brief to suggest why what he said was sketchy enough so that it creates a legitimate matter of disputed fact.
Well, for example, I don't remember if it was Mr. Kaminsky or Ms. Kaminsky, but one of them said whatever documents we had from the 2011 to 19 timeframe were destroyed.
We're
destroyed. So there is a gap in documentation in time.
Well, wait a minute, we've got these invoices.
And that's my point, is that there are these documents that do exist, and then there's a whole swath of documents that no longer exist. I think that's evidence that there's a question as to the credibility of these documents that do exist in the record.
I don't understand. What did you ask Mr. What creates a disputed fact because he said what? He said these are the invoices that were sent in 2011, right?
Right.
Okay, is there anything that in your cross-examination of that witness that suggests that there's a factual dispute about that?
He certainly is consistent that the SMC2 product they use for invalidity is the thing that was being sold to these golf courses. That's what he says. That's what his testimony
says. What he says.
Yes.
And you couldn't get him to not say that.
No.
So presumably if it goes to trial, you've already had the ability to cross-examine him. What beyond attorney argument do you have? I mean, did you offer up any witnesses like the people that were billed to this or whatever, so they could say they never saw it? Was there anything that you offered? And if you didn't, then why isn't this sufficient to at least kind of shift the burden of production, never the burden of persuasion, to you all to at least come up with something You cross-examined him. You could have put on your own, deposed your own witnesses. What is there that makes it sufficient to defeat summary judgment?
And again, that's where I have to take a bit of an issue with your premise and plead a little bit of ignorance, too, because I don't think we got into discovery below to the point where we could have subpoenaed, for example, these golf courses, or subpoenaed people who might have bought a product that was sold by Storis to the golf courses to say, yeah, that was it, what I bought, or it wasn't what I bought. We just didn't have the opportunity below to get to that point.
You didn't have the opportunity to say we wanted to depose these people?
I don't think we were in full-on fact discovery below.
Well, don't you think it's relevant if you made the request? Because if you had the ability to make the request and didn't, isn't the onus on you?
Well, again, I think the point of the briefing below and here is that those kinds of issues are issues that are plausible issues that would be uncovered if discovery progressed. And so that's why you're articulating all the reasons why summary judgment wasn't appropriate at the stage it was granted.
But typically, wouldn't invoices and somebody authenticating them, as you say, not falling apart on cross-examination, saying, yes, these are invoices, this material was sent, isn't that sufficient unless you come up with some reason to, I mean, they can't, as a matter of their initial burden, have to not just submit invoices for the record that they say are accurate, but also bring in the customers and 14 other people to say these are actual invoices, right?
No, I agree, but I think it would be a different situation if there was no question that what was being referred to as a smart money clip 2 is the thing that is being charted against the prior art. And so again, our approach below was, here are all the problems with the various pieces of evidence you're using to show me what Smart Money Clip 2 was. So there's discussions about, like I said, the black versus the silver, the ones with the clip versus without the clip. There's just different pictures, different drawings, different data documents about what...
And you had the chance to cross-examine Kaminsky, so I'm sorry. Tell me again what question he raised, where you sort of... There's a hole in his testimony that leads you to say we don't know what the smart money clip in the invoice was?
Well, you can look, I think, even at in our brief, we cite to his declaration.
Okay. Well, why don't you give me the cite to his declaration? That would be great.
Yeah, so if you look at page 26 of our first brief, our red brief.
Okay, well, why don't you just give me the cite to the appendix?
It's appendix 294.
Okay.
And are you there?
I'm here. Okay.
And there, Mr. Kaminsky says, the SMC2 design has remained relatively unchanged since 2011. So even his own testimony prepared for purposes of supporting a motion.
Where are you? I'm looking at number 6 on 294, and it says the SMCI had the same design from 2011 to the present.
Let me make sure that I've got the right...
You did. You were talking about paragraph 3.
Correct. Sorry.
About paragraph 6.
Okay.
Correct, yes. Paragraph 3 on appendix page 294.
Okay. And paragraph 3 says the design has remained relatively unchanged.
Right.
So you're saying because he said relatively unchanged, did you cross-examine him and say, what do you mean by that? What is the difference? What is the change?
I don't think on this declaration we cross-examined him because this was the one in support of summary judgment. So, but my point is, even on the declaration he prepared for the summary judgment motion, he can't say unequivocally that it did not change, which confirms what I was talking about before, where there's discrepancies in the evidence about what SMC2 is or was at a particular point in time. And those discrepancies are the ones that flow through to the invoices, where even if they are true invoices, and something called Smart Money Clip 2 was sold to a golf course, we don't know what it looked like, because even Mr. Kaminsky can't say it was always the same thing.
Okay, and can you look at 724 of the appendix? Because this is just a court's analysis. So what does he mean? This is on the second full paragraph where he says, defendant does not dispute that the SMCI-II meets each limitation, but instead respond that plaintiff did not offer sufficient evidence to corroborate his self-serving testimony that it was not. Doesn't that sound like the district court at least didn't understand you to be disputing what the product was or whether it was different?
The way I read that is the district court saying, you didn't tell me that the picture in the chart, one of the pictures in the chart, doesn't meet the limitation. And again, looking at the claim chart pictures, there are a smattering of pictures about what the contention is for invalidity. I think this is part of the problem too. If you recall from our brief, that chart started out as a combination obviousness and anticipation chart, and it never changed. So an obviousness theory was ultimately not pursued, but there is a single claim chart that has a bunch of different pictures in it. There's discussions about products called the SMC Lite, for example. And the point that we make in to the district court below, and the way I read him to understand that, is we can't tell what the SMC2 is. We're not saying that the feature in the claim is not shown somewhere in a picture. But for purposes of opposing this motion, there is not clear and convincing evidence that a thing called the SMC2, which was prior art, had all the features in the claim, which is what you need for anticipation.
Can I take you back before we get down to sort of where we started a few minutes ago, which is the fact that the judge said the whole patent goes on anticipation, even though there were only claims left. Given that in your appeal, you haven't challenged that. I mean, you've challenged whether or not there should be summary judgment of anticipation because of the lack of corroboration, but you have not explicitly challenged the scope of that award, i.e. the whole patent versus the claims. Is there a waiver, therefore, on your part for us to tell the judge, if we were to tell the judge anything, that, it was too broad?
I would say no for a couple of reasons. Number one, we do have in our briefing an argument that they can't meet the channel means element of the independent claim. And so if that is true, if the court finds there's a question of fact as to whether or not the channel means limitation is met, because there was no analysis under the 112F construction that is now...
Okay, but let's assume we're not buying that 112F issue.
Okay.
Let's assume we're not buying it.
So my other response to that would be there was no counterclaim of invalidity, and so the judge's ruling at most is that there's no liability for infringement. He found essentially that there was a good defense of invalidity, but there's not a mechanism below where he has the power to actually invalidate any claims because there is no counterclaim for invalidity.
Okay, and the tricky thing in this case, which is making all of our heads explode, is that that's different in inequitable conduct where the whole patent would blow up.
The whole patent?
Even if it's an affirmative defense and not a counterclaim, I don't know.
Yeah, I think inequitable conduct, the law of inequitable conduct says you have to kind of look at how bad the conduct was when you're going to look at the scope of the impact of the inequitable conduct. So there's a lot more there. I think that underscores the fact we haven't done all the briefing on that issue yet. But again, I would come back to there's only defenses here. It's defenses to the allegations of infringement, and that's what the judge was deciding.
You said discovery was limited. Will we see an order somewhere in the district court docket that indicated you didn't get all the discovery you wanted?
I'm not sure there's an order. I know that there are in the docket requests to take certain discovery as part of the briefing process. So at various times, the parties went to the court and said, hey, I'd like to take this discovery for purposes of the briefing that's going on here. I'm not sure there's an affirmative order that says discovery is limited. I do think a 26F...
I'm sorry, will we see that those requests were denied?
No, they were granted. The requests, and I believe they were all for party discovery. It was always for a deposition of a party.
And I take it then you did not oppose summary judgment of anticipation on the grounds that you had not had adequate discovery, did you?
I don't think that was part of our briefing. No. We just said that the evidence that's here isn't enough to carry the clear and convincing burden to establish that something called SMC2 is prior art. If the panel has no further questions, okay.
Any more questions for counsel at the moment?
No, thank you.
I know that you have some rebuttal time, depending on what we hear in response from Mr. Longman.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll take whatever time the court gives me, but I have about a minute's worth of quick points to make. First, on the discovery...
Tell us what you need to tell us.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. Recognizing that my colleague was not at the trial court, he was not in the case during the trial court proceedings, there was full discovery. Discovery was wide open. Third-party discovery was permitted. There was no what we used to call Rule 56F motion during the summary judgment proceedings. So there was no limit on... defendant in this case, below was defendant, their ability to take full discovery.
So what is your view on the, this is on anticipation.
Correct.
I don't want to interrupt you if you want to go to something else first, but that the burden was on them, that you put on enough so that the burden shifted to them to come up with something to
Correct.
Say why the invoices were not. And what about what your friend points to is the so-called arguably squishy language in the deposition so that we didn't really know what product was involved in these invoices. What say you to that?
Well, correct. So as cases normally proceed before a district court, full deposition was taken of Mr. Kaminsky, for example. Thereafter, discovery closed. They took the deposition, obviously, of Mr. Kaminsky. He was my client. So thereafter, discovery closed, we filed a summary judgment motion, and the evidence from Mr. Kaminsky was presented by us in the form of a declaration, not deposition testimony, right? Much cleaner. It's much more sensible for the court. So then the burden, and that declaration was replete with authenticating everything, invoices, images of the product, testimony of the history of the product. So there was historical testimony, corroboration out the you-know-what, and of course we would submit that the burden was then on them to come forward with some equivocal testimony from the prior deposition or some Rule 56F, we need some third parties in here or something. They didn't do that. They argued that the evidence wasn't perfect. Well, that's not the standard. In fact,
they didn't use the word perfect, right?
Well, as I think the court has referenced, they made a lot of attorney argument about, well, we're not quite sure that this document really lines up with this or that, but it wasn't any evidence. It was just attorney argument. So that's my word. They contended it wasn't perfect.
So what did they now, need to do that they didn't do?
Pardon?
What did they need to do that they did not do?
Well, had I been in their position, I would have opposed summary judgment with testimony from third parties. Who bought? Who's on the invoice? Who bought this product back in 2011? Let's talk to them. Let's get their deposition testimony. Is the invoice fake? Does that look real to you? You know, any number of things they could have done to undercut with actual evidence the evidence that we submitted.
The trial judge would have necessarily allowed that? I mean, that's like having a mini trial in connection with the summary judgment motion. If you start bringing in your evidence and you're refuting. So you think the district court would have allowed that?
Of course, that's what summary judgment's all about. We put forward our evidence showing that there's no genuine initial material fact. They come back with evidence, not attorney argument, evidence of some material fact.
But what they argued in part was that your client's credibility was an issue of fact. That's directly in their brief in opposition to your motion for summary judgment. And they said, they had the legal argument that you needed independent corroboration, but putting that aside, they also said, I think, as a fallback, not every juror necessarily is going to find that the limited documentation that appears to corroborate your clients is going to amount to clear and convincing evidence. Where,
sure.
If at all, did the district court address whether a finder of fact would be compelled to find that your evidence was sufficient to meet your burden? And wasn't that something the district court had to do?
Well, certainly in district court's order was very thick and 10 pages at least, discussing all of the issues, going through every argument that they made, rejecting each one, and saying, I don't know if it addressed credibility per se very specifically, but certainly the court is in the best position on summary judgment to know whether a credibility issue perhaps that comes up on the stand at trial, some answer that was different from something given in the deposition transcript, some aha moment where the jury says, well, this guy isn't believable.
I guess my question is, why isn't it enough for the patentee in this instance to say, we think that the credibility of the purported prior art inventor needs to be tested in front of a jury? It's flimsy evidence. It's not nearly as much evidence as one would expect if you'd sold this product for 10 years. Let's put it in front of a jury. Why is that not enough to defeat summary judgment?
Well, that was their argument. And it's not enough because the district court rejected it. And the district court is in the best position to know the standard for summary judgment and whether he thinks that the evidence they presented to...
If we think the district court essentially made a credibility finding, doesn't that mean the district court erred? District court's not supposed to make credibility findings on summary judgment, is it?
Correct, but unless there is evidence to undermine the credibility of what's stated in the declaration. The record on summary judgment was declaration from our client, corroborating documents from our client,
and then lots of questions about
attorney argument
that made sense.
Right, attorney argument.
What authority can you point to that says that's not enough to defeat summary judgment in this context?
Well, no authority specifically other than summary judgment requires opposing evidence. So there has to be something for the district court to say that the credibility is an issue of fact for the trier of fact because...
There's some reference to some copyright Are you familiar with that? That maybe at a certain point your clients tried to get copyright protection?
It's not ringing a bell.
That's fine.
On that. But so that's the anticipation issue. Their arguments were the same on inequitable conduct, by the way, where they said, well, he's not credible, and what he says, this anticipatory prior art isn't really anticipatory prior art. But it was just attorney argument. Now, going quickly to the claim construction issue. There's a reason this court coined the phrase cardinal sin of claim construction years ago. And I would just point to the evolution of that case law, which this court knows
I lost what you were saying.
The cardinal sin of claim construction. And so we submit that that's what's going on here. Certainly there's language you can pull from the specification to say, well, it's the invention. But we submit that the case law from this court is replete, including the control circuits case that we cited in our brief, that where the court said over and over again, but in this case at 797, disclosing only one embodiment without more does not result in a clear disavowal of claim scope. Now, one could argue there is more, but the more, as Judge Stark took my colleague through, it's maybe some of this and some of that. We submit that.
I don't understand what you're saying, disclosure of one embodiment. When we talk about, don't you think when we say one embodiment, it's the spec that calls it an embodiment? In this instance, there was no reference to this being an embodiment.
Sure.
In most of these specs, there are things called embodiments, and of course, we can't limit it to the disclosed embodiments. But isn't this different? You meant, well, before you were calling it the best mode, not an embodiment.
Well, it's one embodiment, so therefore it is the best mode. Now, I think that, Your Honor, we would submit that we don't want to, this court is repeatedly cautioned against form over substance, the language of incantation. I think this court has repeatedly said, watch out for this cardinal sin of importing limitations from the specification into the claims. Now, I do agree that patent lawyers need to watch their language, and they need to be, you know, on point about it. Say embodiment when they mean embodiment, and don't say the invention when they don't mean the invention is therefore limited to. But we submit that, on balance, looking at the complete record, the district court erred in committing the cardinal sin on the claim term lips. And that's what I wanted to say.
To be practical on this, when we're talking only about the composition of the lip, is that right? Plastic or the kind of plastic, or the plastic against metal?
Correct. The district court said that it's got to be extrudable or injectable plastic material, and took that from the spec into its claim construction. That's what lips have to be. And that's what we oppose, as we submit was error. And finally, very quickly, we didn't talk much about the trade dress issue, but like Judge Stark just took me on...
I'm sorry, are you going to talk about trade dress?
Very quickly.
Well, I'll defer to my colleagues, but it seems like you're here on rebuttal, and it's, the other side will not be able to respond to what you say on your main appeal, because they're only going to respond on the cross-appeal. So I think I'll defer to our presiding judge, but I don't think it's appropriate for you to raise it here on rebuttal.
Fair enough.
Well, at the risk of overdoing, I take a few minutes on trade dress.
I just need...
It does seem to me the entire issue is that, well, they just copied our product. That somewhere or other... can't be completely ignored. So if my colleagues are willing to listen a little more, take a couple of minutes on trade dress.
I can be very quick, Your Honor. I'll try. Sometimes I say that and then I'm not. But in reference to the discussion I just had with Judge Stark, where he said, well, wait a minute, isn't it enough to avoid summary judgment? Just, you know, get something in there and create a question. Obviously, I disagree on anticipation that that's the case. But certainly on the trade dress case here, we oppose the motion for summary judgment with detailed declarations, evidence, corroborating documents. And on one of the 3 points on the trade dress case that they moved on, non-functionality, secondary meaning, and abandonment, the movement had the burden on abandonment. Okay? They have to show on summary judgment that there's no triable fact that could ever convince a jury that there was not abandonment. Now, on summary judgment in the light most favorable to the non-movement, look at the evidence we put into the record. Not only the abandonment issue, but the issue of non-functionality and secondary meaning, and we submit that in accordance with the discussion I just had with Judge Stark, on the trade dress issue, certainly it is the case that we raised many issues of fact, trade dress being one of the most fact-intensive issues that we have in our jurisprudence, and we submit that the evidence there was at least enough to get a denial of summary judgment. With no further questions,
okay.
Thank you.
Any more questions for counsel?
No.
All
right, then we'll hear from Mr. Weed on the rebuttal time. And, of course, Judge Prost was correct. The trade dress wasn't raised in the argument in chief. So if you want to comment on trade dress as well, we'll hear you.
Understood. Thank you. I did want to start briefly again with the 808 patent issue, and I mentioned the Zenith Electronics case a moment ago, and I think that case is very instructive because that case was very, very similar to what happened here. In that case, a patent challenger essentially said, hey, these patent claims are invalid because the thing that's being accused of infringement is in the prior art. And the court ultimately said, no, that's not enough. You have to tell us why a limitation is met by the prior art. You kind of do this shortcut approach to patent invalidity to get to the right result. And what the court said there in that case at 522 F 3rd 1348 is it said, quote, a non-movement need not always provide affidavits or other evidence to defeat a summary judgment motion. In the Zenith case, just like here, a shortcut was taken to try to prove invalidity. Here the shortcut was, we're not going to address the claim construction that the court entered, which is now not on appeal, the construction of the 112.6 issue, which I understand the court is aware of. But the fact of the matter is, the movement here didn't do any analysis of that limitation as was required. There's no evidence about how a person of ordinary skill in the art would have interpreted the structure or the function. And that's not trivial because it is a 112.6 limitation that will bind my client when it's trying to prove infringement. And so essentially, allowing the summary judgment of anticipation to stand here is doing what the Zenith court cautioned against, which was allowing the challenger to shortcut the issue of invalidity in a way where we wouldn't have been able to do the same if we got all the way through and had to prove infringement. So I do think it's a very important point. And the Zenith court tells us we don't always have to come forward with evidence when it's just so facially deficient that it can't carry the burden.
I think the copyright point I was struggling for is at the end of the district court's opinion.
It is.
It's got a footnote. The court agrees with plaintiff that the alleged publication date of the SMC2 copyright is irrelevant to when it was first sold publicly. Can you help me on that? Is there evidence on copyright? Is that a dispute?
I don't think there's a dispute that the copyright date is what it is, but part of the evidence developed in this case was, as I mentioned, there was sort of a destruction of documents that occurred. Our client put in declarations detailing Google web searches that he did to try to find out whether Storis or the Smart Money Clip was available for sale during the period of time where the documents didn't exist anymore. And what he says in his declaration is at 1574 and 1575 of the appendix, he essentially details what he did to try to verify that Storis was in fact out there doing anything. And so obviously we have the evidence from Storis about the alleged sales of something called SMC2. My client, who's in the industry, went out and said, I've never heard of them. This is strange. He did Google searches. He did Wayback Machine searches. He didn't find any evidence that Storis was out there in the marketplace doing anything. And so that is evidence, I think, to corroborate Judge Stark, the copyright point, which is that there wasn't really anything going on in the time period when Storis says it was making prior art sales. And of course, it's not perfect evidence. We don't have trial evidence yet, but the jury certainly could look at what my client did and say, hey, I believe him. There's nothing on the web. There's no Google searches. He's telling you in one of the paragraphs of his declaration, I went to the website where it's currently being sold or where I believe it would have been sold, and there was no Wayback Machine version of that website until 2019. So there's evidence there from our client along the vein of the copyright issue to try to demonstrate that the assertion that SMC2 was being sold prior to the filing of our patent application is not true.
Is this declaration of 1574 from Mr. Kane that was in the record on summary judgment?
That is in opposition to the summary judgment motions, yes.
Thank you.
And I believe in the appendix we provided, I think the excerpts of the motion are just before that document in the appendix. Aside from that, I don't have any further comments either on the trade dress issues or on the patent issues, unless the panel has questions.
Okay. And any more questions from the panel?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.